Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of Press One for Democracy. This is Dan Aronson, your host, coming to you every Monday at 6 p.m. on the Pacific Time, 9 p.m. on the East Coast. And ladies and gents, we have a doozy for you, I promise. We're going to be talking about some very important issues, and we're going to be talking about them with an incredibly, we're incredibly lucky to have this person, a special guest. Liz Kennedy from Demos is going to be on hand to interact, answer all the questions you might have about our topic for the evening, which tonight is going to be the upcoming case of McCutchen versus the FEC, which is going to be oral arguments will start on this case in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, October the 8th. And I'm not going to get into a ton of detail because I'm going to let Liz really set it up, but in short, there is currently an aggregate limit of donations that any one person can give within any two-year or biennial period directly to candidates. And Mr. McCutchen, a wealthy businessman from Alabama, is bringing suit to have that limit removed, claiming quite like in Citizens United that it is a stifling of his first degree or his First Amendment freedom of speech. So, again, we're going to bring in Liz Kennedy. But before we do, I want to give you a little background, tell you about who Liz is, tell you about that Demos set it up, and then we'll bring Liz in and we'll get right to it. So Liz Kennedy is counsel for Demos. She's working specifically on money and politics, voting rights, and corporate accountability. She works to expand political participation and to prevent voter disenfranchisement by eliminating barriers to voting and empowering voters. Liz focuses on money and politics to increase transparency and accountability for political spending, near and dear to coffee party hearts, obviously, and works towards political equality and to fight corruption of democratic government. She develops policies, rights, and works with partners across the country. To give you an idea of how prolific an author Liz is, she has written several books, written or co-written, including Bullets to the Ballot Box, Democracy at Stake, Protecting Democracy in the Super PAC Era, Citizens Actual United, Protecting the Freedom to Vote, and 10 Ways Citizens United Endangers Democracy. So, again, very prolific. She hails out of NYU Law School, where she graduated cum laude with her law degree, and she's been published in publications across the country, including the American Prospect, Civic Review, a Human Rights Journal of the American Bar Association, the Boston Herald, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Los Angeles Daily News, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, The Hills, Congress Blog, and The Huffington Post. So, again, we are very, very happy and ecstatic, let's say, to have Liz on hand. Now, the organization Liz works for, Demos. Now, Demos, for you, those of you scholarly types who are all about etymology, the word is Demos is the root word for democracy, and it comes from the meaning the people. It reminds us that in America, the true source of our greatness is the diversity of our people. Our nation's highest challenge is to create democracy that truly empowers people of all backgrounds so that we all have a say in setting the policies that shape opportunity and to provide for a common future. And the thing that struck me when I was reviewing Demos's about page, which you can find at demos.org, is that they have three basic, what they call overreaching commitments: achieving true democracy by reducing the role of money in politics, and guaranteeing the freedom to vote. Number two, creating pathways to ensure a diverse, expanded middle class in a new sustainable economy. Friends of the show will know that always tops my list as the main goal that we need to get our government working towards is creating a sustainable economy that drives middle class jobs with middle class incomes, and restoring the middle class that has been gutted by the crash of 2008 and only very partially recovered in this, what I like to call the faux recovery, where so many people lost middle class and middle wage jobs only to find that the only jobs that were available in the recovery were low class and low wage jobs. So tops on my list. And then number three, transforming the public narrative to elevate the values of community and racial equality. So again, in reviewing these things, I was just kind of a little bit blown away by the fact that these overreaching commitments, as Demos calls them, are totally in lockstep with the with what the Coffee Party is all about. So again, very excited to have somebody who is at the forefront of the fight against money in politics. And so without further ado, let's bring in Liz Kennedy.
It's really a pleasure. I'm so glad to be able to spend some time chatting with you and with anybody else who has managed to listen to us here in the space talking about these issues, because they are important and they happen whether we're paying attention or not. So it's great when we're able to connect on them and talk about what we need to do to, in this instance, to fight the improper influence of money on our government.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful thing. So I think you'll find that to a person, I see a lot of our regular callers in queue. I'm sure they'll be anxious to get to asking you questions. But before we do, I thought I'd set up the show by asking you, you know, basically a few questions. And let's start, if you don't mind, by summarizing, you know, giving us a little elevator speech on what exactly this action is and what are the people who are bringing it trying to accomplish when we're talking about McCutcheon v. FEC.
Sure. So McCutcheon v. FEC, as you said, is the Supreme Court's next money in politics to be argued in under a month. What this case is Sean McCutcheon, a businessman, is bringing, along with the RNC, is challenging the constitutionality of what are called aggregate contribution limits. And the thing to remember here is that contribution limits serve in order to fight against corruption and the appearance of corruption of democratic government. And that's why the government has the power to enact common sense rules in order to set up some barriers between those that have financial power and the political realm, which is supposed to be based on, you know, one person, one vote and democratic values. So one of the ways that we have those barriers is the aggregate contribution limit, which limits individual people from contributing more than about $125,000 directly to candidates or their committees or their political parties. And what that does is, you know, actually just make sure that any one individual in 2 years can't spend, they can donate to as many different candidates and PACs and parties as they want, but they can't donate more than about $50,000, you know, they break down. So that, it's not chilling anyone's speech, it's just setting up some rules. The plaintiffs here are challenging those rules and saying that they unconstitutionally burden their First Amendment right to political speech, and we argue that it does not unconstitutionally burden their right to political speech, because the First Amendment allows for space where the government, a democratic government, needs to set up common sense rules so that it doesn't get overwhelmed and, in fact, captured by private economic interests, which is really what we've seen happening with the overflow of big money into politics, even with the current rules that we already have. These aggregate contribution limits have been upheld previously by the Supreme Court on more than one occasion. Back in Buckley v. Valeo, they upheld them. As recently as in McConnell, they said good things about them. Even in Citizens United, Justice Kennedy said that if the elected officials are succumbing to the improper influence, you know, dealing with campaign finance, then there would be cause for concern. And there is cause for concern, and so we are telling the Supreme Court that they really need to uphold these aggregate contribution limits in accordance with all of their precedent, because a democratic government has the power to defend itself against the improper role of money in government, which right now is really impacting a lot of issues that impact real Americans, and that's why this matters so much.
All right. Well, thank you. That was a wonderful synopsis there. But just so that we can be clear, just a couple of things I wanted to point out there. So first of all, we're not talking about really the types of donations that were being being discussed and were ruled on in Citizens United, in that these are direct donations given that I would walk into some congressman's office, I would cut him a check for whatever the legal limit was, and it would go right to them, and this is not going to a PAC or a super PAC or a dark money organization. This is a direct contribution to the candidates and the parties.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Do I have that right?
And basically
McCutcheon's assertion is that if there's a legal limit per donation to a specific candidate, I should be able to write that up to that legal limit to all of 535 or 1,000 different candidates, and that should be legal. And this aggregate limit is what he's complaining about.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool, excellent, good. Well, now that I've got that right, excellent. Well. So before we go on, just let me remind everybody, as I did before, you couldn't hear me, that this is a call-in show, and we want you to be active and participate. We have a wonderful guest here and a fantastic resource, so anybody who wants to call in, the number is 646-929-2495, and when you want to join the conversation, just press 1 on your keypad, and we will get to you as soon as we can. So if you could then, given the setup of the case, what do you see as the ramifications for, and let's go, we'll go take both scenarios, right? So let's say McCutcheon is successful, which, of course, none of us want him to be, but let's say he is successful. What are the ramifications besides the lifting of the limits?
Well, I don't think that we should necessarily go straight, well, hey. I don't think we should go straight to if he's successful, although, of course, we can discuss that. We should talk, of course, about why we should, in fact, win on the merits. It can be easy sometimes to adopt a view where one thinks that, people are inevitably going to go one way, but I don't think that that is really something that should be taken for granted here necessarily because, according to all our president, we should have been. But to your point.
Well, hold on. I'm you know what? I'm willing to go that way. And the only reason why I asked you basically to that way is because when I posted this on our Facebook page and promoted the show, there were many, many comments that came back on it, and most of them were of the gloom and doom type. So I tell you what, let's go a different way. I like your way better. Let's give these folks reason to believe, and myself included, that we will prevail here, and if you can explain to us why we'll prevail, that would be awesome.
Sure. I can, and then, of course, I do want to tell your listeners, and you are right to point out that if the court goes the wrong way, one wealthy donor would be able to contribute more than $3.5 million to one of the parties and all of their candidates should these limits go down. And then, of course, if these limits go down, it also just further signifies, you know, the activist direction that the Roberts Court has chosen to take vis-a-vis the First Amendment and money in politics and, frankly, on so many other issues, particularly those impacting other very important democratic issues such as voting rights. But then, depending on, you know, the breadth of any of the decisions that might get written, one could look at contribution limits being called into question in a way that they absolutely have not been since Buckley. And so let me start there, however, in climbing our way out and in looking at, frankly, the quite firm ground that McCutcheon is on within the Supreme Court's past jurisprudence, and then, frankly, the new ground that we really ought to be able to understand, whereby the First Amendment must have space within it to allow for a democratic government to set up common sense rules, to protect elected officials from improper influence and therefore protect the legitimacy and integrity of representative government, right? Because that's what this is about. So I will tell you about our brief, if I may, as a way to start, or at least, look, since Buckley, the court has not struck down a federal contribution limit. And the only time that they struck down one state contribution limit was based on it being too low, not because it was unconstitutional for being a contribution limit and, you know, thereby limiting speech. Because, in fact, the court has found in the past, this is a quote, limitations on money in politics prevent the real or imagined coercive influence of large financial contributions on candidates' positions and on their actions if elected to office. They then say it in another case. Take away Congress's authority to regulate the appearance of undue influence and the cynical assumption that large donors call the tune could jeopardize the willingness of voters to take part in democratic government. So that's why past courts have upheld campaign finance laws, and even Justice Kennedy, if I may, in Citizens United, and then this will be the last since it's not a law lecture, I recognize, but I do, you know, I do find comfort in the actual decisions. Even in Citizens United, Justice Kennedy said, quote, if elected officials succumb to improper influences, if they surrender their best judgment, and if they put expediency before principle, then surely there is cause for concern. So we're telling the court there is cause for concern, there clearly is cause for concern. You know, the last elections were not only the most expensive in history, but most importantly, they were dominated by a smaller percentage of the wealthy than and the donor class than we have really ever seen. 84% of members elected to the House of Representatives in 2012 and more than half of the members of the Senate received more money from the 1% of the 1% than from all of their small donors combined. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about improper influence, and we can talk about Americans' attitudes about it. I'll stop filibustering for a moment there.
No. That was great. That was great. So here's the one thing, and I'm sure I've gotten this wrong, and you'll correct me on this. But as part of the as part of the majority opinion in Citizens United, I seem to remember some verbiage by one of the justices coming out as something to the effect of the mere appearance of impropriety isn't enough. Or not, it wasn't the mere appearance. It was just because somebody's giving you a lot of money.
You
have to be able to prove quid pro quo to make it to say it's corrupt. But isn't there some kind of language
exactly
like that?
Right. Nope, you are exactly right, Dan. He said mere access and influence is not corruption.
Yeah, that's scary.
I was like, did I lose you? I'm constantly convinced that the cell phone call is going to drop, by the way. So, that was just a dramatic pause. That is scary. It's problematic. It is, however, in that decision, he was speaking, as you said earlier, about the distinction. He was talking about, quote, independent expenditures. That is to say, formally uncoordinated with the candidate. So in that instance, he was saying independent expenditures cannot corrupt since they are, quote, unquote, independent. And therefore, if all you see is some kind of access and influence, then that's not corruption. But may I now discuss American public opinion? Because over 80, almost 90% of Americans understand that it is corruption when a member of Congress does a business or individual a favor because they've received financial support. It's, again, about 85% understands it to be corruption if a member of Congress was acting in the interest of financial supporters instead of in the interest of constituents. And about the same, about maybe 84, I'm reading off of a graph, not the numbers, obviously, calls it corruption if a member of Congress is acting in the interest of financial supporters instead of in his or her best judgment. And actually, Americans, again, over 80%, say that it is corruption when financial supporters have more access and influence with members of Congress than average Americans. So first of all, Americans just...
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
No, I'm like, I.
Well, here's it. I hear what you're saying, and it makes total sense. And it was about those same numbers of supporters that came out right after Citizens United and said, we disagree in Congress. We want you to do something about it, make a law, do something, but you know, pass legitimate campaign finance reform because we don't like this. But here's when I hear people say things like that, I'm not sure necessarily they're thinking it all the way through, because you know those. There's two sides to the story, and I think most people within many organizations, certainly I think within ours, only really think of people like the Koch brothers, you know, when they think of people who are trying to wield this undue influence. But isn't it also true that labor unions and, you know, other people, I mean, activist organizations have lobbyists, they give money to campaigns? I mean, sometimes it's people we would think of as the good guys trying to assert the influence. Does it mean everybody gets to or nobody gets to? Is that really the only choice to make it fair?
I think you might be talking about a couple of different things, because I think that while we talk about the importance, it is really critical to, and you know, one of the real issues of our time, to not go back to the Gilded Era where, you know, Congress people, Senator Clark, out of Montana, you know, literally actually buying Senate seats. So we really need some common sense rules. But, you know, the First Amendment is a beautiful thing. Freedom of association, freedom of expression are core, you know, constitutional American values that we need to absolutely respect in terms of people's right to petition the government and engage in advocacy. So this isn't really at all about speech. The point is, in a democracy, the size of your wallet shouldn't determine the impact of your voice, and it should not determine your right to representation. But what we have right now is a state of affairs where 60% of Americans think that their members of Congress will vote in the interests of their financial supporters, and only 20% of Americans think that they would vote in the favor of their voters' interests. You know, American confidence in Congress is at its lowest, and we're seeing that because Americans believe that government is more responsive to the interests of their donors than voters, and in fact, research shows, and this is what we presented in our brief, research shows government actually is more responsive to the policy preferences of the wealthy than to the policy preferences of those in the bottom economic group. Almost 80% of Americans agree with the statement, I'm worried that large political contributions will prevent Congress from tackling the important issues facing America today, like the economic crisis, rising energy costs, reforming healthcare, and global warming. And in fact, we looked at several new social and political science studies, and in this one study called Affluence and Influence, Professor Martin Gillens examined the extent to which policy preferences of different income groups were reflected in actual policy outcomes. And here's what he said. The American government does respond to the public's preferences, but that responsiveness is strongly tilted toward the most affluent citizens. Indeed, under most circumstances, the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact on which policy the government does or doesn't adopt. So that's really disheartening when you think about the nature of elected representation in our system. And so that's why we need to make space for lobbying and legitimate advocacy, but we have to make sure that it's not a function of your ability to wield financial resources in the electoral or government affairs realm.
Wow. Yeah, well said, and I'm in. Where do I sign?
People are coming to the court.
Yeah, you got one. Now we just need about 60, 70 more million to go. We're in. Actually, what I'd like to do now is I'd like to bring in one of our regular great friends of the show. He actually substitutes for me sometimes from time to time when I'm not available to the show. Mr. Bobby Rodrigo calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Bobby Rodrigo, you are on the air.
Good evening. How is everybody tonight? Nice to hear your conversation, Liz.
Thanks, buddy.
I wouldn't call myself a member of the gloom and doom, but here's I'm going to try and get to a question, but here's my problem with this situation that we're in. My first problem is that, of course, this is a case about an individual as opposed to Citizens United being an aspect of corporations being thought of as people. So it's really not the same kind of a case, though it creates the same bad problem that the court rules what we would consider the wrong way in this conversation. But my concern with what you're saying, what you're describing, is though obviously all those points are valid, but we are talking about a constitutional court ruling about something, whether or not it's constitutional. So from my review of this, I want to know how much time is being spent on arguing the validity of whether or not money should be considered a form of speech. Now, and before you answer, the one thing I will say about the court's ability to say that the regulations are fine is that we all know that free speech can be regulated. That's why you can't stand up in a movie theater and yell fire. They've allowed for that type of thing. Isn't it more accurate in a constitutional forum to put aside policy statements and polling and research and public view and actually argue the right of the government to regulate something that obviously is detrimental to society on a constitutional basis? What would be your opinion of that?
Absolutely, Bobby. That is a really good and interesting point. I think that several things. It is, of course, actually, being argued on constitutional grounds, and we can talk about, I think I was talking a little bit about some of the balancing things that need to go on there, but we can definitely talk about the different constitutional standards that they might apply. One of the reasons why I like to bring in the public opinion and the policy questions is that sometimes I think this issue gets discussed in a really bloodless way that seems to only be about either these kind of conceptual constitutional issues or just kind of dollars and cents regulatory things. And so we often lose the connection to the manner in which the improper influence of money in our government right now is blocking needed economic reforms. It's, absolutely...
It's insane.
So those are some things. But I think that you make an excellent point about needing to discuss some of the constitutional problems. We do not get to... It's not a question in this case, although, as to whether money is actually speech, although it's, certainly a question that still, is debated, and that when in 1976, when Buckley v. Valeo was decided, that, Judge Skelly Wright, had some interesting pieces on his money speech. So they just, it's certainly still something that is a debatable question. So, and I mean, I would certainly say that money is not speech, I think. Money is seen to be facilitating speech. Justice Stevens, I think came out and was talking about reconsidering some of those things. So what's interesting is that in the realm of campaign finance jurisprudence, there are settled precedents, and that's, what undergirds the foundation below McCutcheon. But that it has also been contested territory.
Well, you have three things going on in the campaign finance world from the litigation aspect. You have obviously corporations are people, and as we've discussed on this show, for example, it says it in Article 1, Subsection 1 of the United States Code that any law that is written in the United States Code that says people, it also includes corporations, which is so ludicrous. But they basically took the corporation as a person. The corporations are allowed to enter into contracts way back when at the beginning of our country and ran with it. So thus we have the Citizens United problem. So the corporate personhood issue is one. Money as speech is another. And then you have states like Alabama, for example, that just enacted a law on August 1st, it just came into effect, that removed campaign limits of corporations to supply contributions to anybody. So the trend from the standpoint of at least the conservative states will say, but the trend is to remove the handcuffs of the corporations. So my gloom and doom assessment of doing anything other than a narrow constitutional argument is that everybody wants to put as much money into it as they want, and if the court does become activist, that's the way that they'll go. So wouldn't it be a better thought process to narrow it as much as possible? Because it's hard enough with Scalia and Thomas, and Roberts to avoid activism. Obviously, I mean, in the last 10 years, the court has been ridiculously activist. And you can say the same thing about the Warren Court in the 60s, though we needed that, some of those things that they were doing. But they also went beyond the narrow constitutional duty of the court, and they're obviously doing it now. Well, we're seeing a trend that's wanting to open up these campaign finance laws, and I'm concerned that when the wider the argument, the more of a chance that the court sees that they can do this. Because Citizens United, the issue wasn't even before them what they ruled upon. They actually expanded the case, I'm sure you know. And so why not try and narrow it just to the money aspect of it and make them rule about that very important aspect? They may rule badly, but make them rule on that very important aspect as some kind of a foundation is my concern. Because
Hold on. Let's let our guest answer you.
Yeah, sorry.
I was just asking.
No, Bobby's a very passionate guy. We're very used to it. It's okay. It's all good.
Sure. My question for you, actually, rather than an answer, was: are you suggesting that we should narrow this to the question of whether money is speech?
I think that the chances of victory
if that's
are
what
also
you,
better than now. Yeah.
They have already held that money is speech, right? I mean, that's the basis.
Yeah.
That analysis, that money is speech, essentially that equation, is the basis for campaign finance jurisprudence. Because if they didn't consider the spend, and by they, I just mean certain majorities in certain cases over the long-standing, decades that these issues have been before the courts since Buckley v. DeLeo, although even before it, really. But particularly there, they then said that political speech, Chief Justice Roberts has famously said, the First Amendment doesn't only protect the lonely pamphleteer, meaning that, even somebody who just wants to go down and, mimeograph a couple campaign flyers needs to buy some cardstock or what have you. So that question is not only not narrow, I would suggest that it's actually one of the very, as you were correctly saying, foundational elements, but it has already been decided. Now, that's what I was saying is still certainly something that others have questioned, and, we argue that it should not be given the same protections as actual human speech, because, the power of your ideas should be why one might, gain currency or influence in a political sphere, not because you've got the bigger checkbook.
Well, so it seems to me, and I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV, and I did not spend a night at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I'm wholly unqualified to say anything on a legal standpoint. But here's the thing: as a guy who thinks he's got a pretty decent, grasp on common sense, speech is speech, and in today's world, money is not speech. What it is it is a method of amplification. So I may have the old, you know, megaphone kind of thing that they had back in the day, right, that's just a piece of paper and it's a big cone, and I can yell as loud as I can. And Bobby's got the little amp that the guy carries around with that, you know, is usually preaching in the park on Sundays. But you have, Liz, you've got the same setup that the Rolling Stones used to play at Wembley Stadium.
Exactly.
That's the difference.
But we've
in
all
money.
Got the same amount of free speech.
Exactly. So just turn off. We're just asking them to turn off the amplifiers. No more amplifiers.
Right.
My voice,
and
your voice, everybody's voice has to be at the same level.
As you said, free speech, your quote was free speech isn't free because you described the fire in a movie theater. An even better example, or another example, is the time, place, and manner restrictions. That as you were saying, you know, when the Rolling Stones were in Wembley Park, that's one thing. But if they were trying to play on my corner at 2 a.m., you know, that would be against the rules. So
that's right.
There's a reason for time, place, and manner restrictions. They allow. There's also, as you also, you know, there's rules that govern speech in legislatures or in the army, right, or in educational spheres. There are different rules. So the electoral sphere could be seen as another arena in which, you know, the point is, and Bobby, to get back to what you were saying about the importance of articulating the constitutional issues, when we only think about the First Amendment as being about just pure this, Congress shall make no law abridging speech, you know, but we just talked about a whole bunch of, you know, there are other important constitutional values, such as our democratic values, where we come together and make decisions as a polity, as citizens, as equal citizens, where we all have the right to representation. And right now, we do not see a situation where Americans actually have, you know, this kind of equal political participation. And one reason is because of the overwhelming influence of big money in funding elections. It's really this dependence, you know, Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard talks about the improper dependence of elected representatives on the donor class. And, you know, we look at the things that really ought to have been done with financial reform. We look at where income inequality is, rather, these days. And, you know, we really need to be able to come together and speak, form our public discourse in a way where we all have more of a voice in this system, and where our government isn't just dependent on the most wealthy. The most wealthy, the 1% of the 1% really dominates the funding of our elections, and that just doesn't lead to a healthy democratic government or then to, you know, progressive or effective real governance.
Well, that's what it boils down to mainly, too, is that it is an equal protection issue as much as anything else. You know, it's almost like the balance. And when, you know, so when I look at the constitutional issue, I'm not trying to narrow the argument, only in the sense of bringing in other issues besides the constitutional argument. But I believe that it is a broad argument, like you were pointing out. The equal protection thing is just as strong as anything else. It's the money being speech is creating an unequal society, which, again, is, you know, obviously something that the 14th Amendment addresses, of course. I'm glad you're fighting the way you are. It is definitely the great fight. There's no way that we have a representative government of our society at the moment. It's just not happening.
I'd like to say that I think they're obviously, I think most of the people, you know, really, this is not a question of bad people. That's an important thing to remember, because it's not about individual, you know, this is about the systemic dependence and then the fact that really this can skew our democratic outcomes because it skews our democratic incomes. No pun intended there. But I certainly don't want to demonize all of government. We just need to look at these campaign finance dynamics and see, you know, the way in which they have been distorting a system and then correct for that. I mean, it's not like we can't pass a congressional public financing program. I mean, you might say that's unlikely right now, but we have an understanding of what we need to do to fight, you know, certain dynamics, which is to empower small donors. You know, we talk about corporate political spending, and, you know, we could go any number of ways to get more disclosure of corporate political spending, A, through congressional legislation, but B, through the proposed SEC rule, which, frankly, you know, the SEC, now the Citizens United, changed the game in terms of releasing all of this new corporate independent spending directly from treasuries, you know, into the political system. Much of it, Citizens United, in that decision, Justice Kennedy assumed it would all be transparent. He talked about the mechanisms of shareholder accountability that would be able to be brought to bear and the importance to voters and investors of knowing what kind of money, you know, what kind of political spending corporations were engaged in. However, due to unfortunate real problems with our disclosure regulations that I won't even get into, but I'm sure people have heard of 501c4s and et cetera, we have not been able to have transparency in what we know is all of this new corporate political spending. But the SEC is looking into that issue, and, you know, experts are weighing in addition to 600,000 Americans and American investors who submitted public comments, which everyone, you know, is invited to do. So, you know, there are a lot of things that can be done. There are a lot of things that people are doing, but there is this constitutional roadblock. We need to develop an understanding that is more in line with American democratic rights, responsibilities, and current needs. And I think, you know, but the first thing we need is to make sure that the Supreme Court doesn't go an even worse way and really overturn its precedent and overturn these aggregate contribution limits, because then the kind of fundraising, both the donations but then the solicitation that we saw taking off with Citizens United when they freed up all the independent spending, could now be imported back into the direct candidate route. And again, candidates could be soliciting, you know, $3.5 million, $1 million from individual donors, which is just really absolutely a direct route to the kind of corruption and appearance of corruption which the government has the right to legislate to protect itself from, that's in line with all of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So, and what I was going to say earlier about, you know, a lot of elected officials in government doing a great job, this really, it's about the way that the improper influence is imported into these things. And I would point your listeners to a quote from Senator Chris Murphy, who noted that he had to spend 4 to 6 hours in call time, right, in fundraising calls, and noting that he's not calling anyone who couldn't drop at least $1,000, he estimates they all make $500,000 to $1 million per year. Because, of course, you know, these people need to make some money, raise some money in a short period of time. So, of course, they're calling the people who can give them this money, right? That part's not hard to understand. So here's Senator Murphy saying, those people making between $500,000 to $1 million a year have fundamentally different problems than other people. And so you're hearing a lot about problems that bankers have and not a lot of problems that people who work at the mill have. You certainly have to stop and check yourself. So,
I absolutely agree with you, and it makes sense. And actually, that's something one of our executive director, Janine Loudon, came up with, was this concept of free the elected. Right. So it's, and when she said it at our retreat, I said, that's brilliant, because as a person who's into martial arts and Japanese culture, one of the most important things is that even when you blame somebody for something or when you accuse somebody, you always give them a way out. So we're going to free you. It's not your fault. You have to do it, just like you said, right? But we're going to free you from having to do that, so you can actually spend time doing what you really want to do, which is to govern in the name of on behalf of your constituent.
Well, that's all a coffee party thing.
Yes. There really are. I mean, that's, I'm sorry, but you'd be surprised. I think that's, and in fact, that's exactly what you see much more of in states that have public financing. Connecticut, for example, has been just really has derived a lot of benefits in the last several years since they have public financing, including being able to pass a lot of legislation, I believe sick leave and certainly some environmental pieces. And they say that the ambiance, but actually, as you were saying, of lobbyists, they were saying now, you know, the impacts are like the way that you just kind of feel with the lobbyists, it's a really different situation. I would urge any interested listeners, Demos did a report called Fresh Start, looking at the benefits of public financing in Connecticut. Because, of course, I am calling in, and it's actually a little bit late now because I'm on the East Coast, but I am from New York, where we hope to adopt the Fair Elections Program next year for New York State, famously a corrupt state government, you know, many of the people carted off in this past year. But really, the issue is you know, in addition to some bad behavior, it's more about the impact of, you know, real estate donations and the way that they impact governance in New York State. And the Moreland Commission, any New Yorkers, the Moreland Commission on Public Corruption is currently holding hearings and taking public comments, and then we'll be making recommendations to Governor Cuomo regarding what kind of programs regarding corruption he should adopt, and clearly he should make public financing and the Fair Elections Program a central plank in those reforms that we really hope to see adopted next spring. And then as more states do that, we can build momentum towards federal passage of the Fair Elections Act. So, you know, this kind of empowering small donors and empowering citizens, you know, fighting voter restrictions so that we can all get to the ballot also, these are all things that we're going to have to work on together. So I urge folks to go to demos.org if you want to find out any more about any of this information. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you guys tonight.
It has been, and I very much appreciate it. So just for those of you joining, or for people who join late or after our little technical difficulty, you are listening to Press One for Democracy. Your host, Dan Aronson, has had the incredible pleasure and honor of hosting Liz Kennedy from Demos. You can go to that website. It's Demos is a really neat organization. I've been reading a lot about it. But what I like for our coffee party listeners is that when you go to their About Demos page, they have three basic overreaching commitments. And that's achieving true democracy by reducing the role of money in politics, check, and guaranteeing the freedom to vote, check, and creating pathways to ensure diverse, expanded middle class in a new sustainable economy, which you didn't get to hear either. Nobody did when I was speaking to myself, but Liz, friends of the show know that that is number one on my list. Let's get the middle class back to work, and let's get sustainable jobs. And, you know, if it's in sustainable energy, that's great, too. That's a win-win as
Absolutely.
Well. But let's get the middle class back to work and stable and stabilize this other and stop this, you know, expanding inequity of opportunity that is just, you know, sweeping the country. And then
Absolutely.
The third thing is transforming public narrative to elevate values and community and racial equity. And our little model is connecting communities to find common solutions to our common problems. So I think it's really neat that Demos and the coffee party at the very root level of principle are like in total lockstep. So I hope this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Fantastic, Dan, and I think that exactly an equal say and an equal chance, and exactly in a society where, you know, we all respect each other is really, I think that so many of us share those principles. That's great when we get to have a conversation and when we get to figure out, you know, how to help each other help change happen, because that's, you know, that's what we can do when we work together, I think, so we can figure out how to do that. And having
Absolutely.
Conversations
so
with one of them.
Yeah, I agreed, and I appreciate your time. If you don't mind, I know we're at the end of your hour that you committed to. Could you give us just a as a kind of a parting idea? Give us because I think some of us feel a little bit helpless when things are in the court system, because we know that, you know, theoretically we're not supposed to be able to influence the courts, and that's mm-hmm. why the judicial branch is the way it is and created the way it mm-hmm. is and staffed the way it is, if you were. So can give us a few suggestions on how what we can do as average citizens to get to try to have some influence on this.
Sure, that's a great question, and I'd love to leave your listeners with that. I think that you make a really good point. I will actually say that I think that certainly the independent integrity of the court and, you know, courts generally, and that there ought to be an understanding of, it's a deliberative body, you know, it's meant to just apply the law. But, so the point is, yes, all of that. But then I also say several other things, which is, I don't know if you're... if your listeners or if you are familiar with the case Caperton v. Massey coming out of West Virginia, but that was a case which went up to the Supreme Court, and actually wherein the Supreme Court found that a litigant had a right to have a judge recuse himself because one of the parties, the Massey Cole, had a judgment against them in the millions of dollars. So they then chose, it's like the Pelican Brief, they then chose to spend a bunch of money in the West Virginia judicial election, like millions of dollars, which like nobody had ever seen in West Virginia judicial politics before. And then that guy gets elected and reverses the like $50 million decision against Massey Cole. And then the other party to that suit sued in federal court and won. Justice Kennedy wrote the decision in Caperton saying that the litigants had a right because of the improper appearance, basically, and so ordered the judge's recusal. But they don't see the same idea about elected officials and how, you know, if one interest is able to spend $3.5 million to elect a candidate and nobody else is, you know, has that kind of comparable financial resources, the idea that that doesn't, accrue to the benefit of the person who's spending that money. I think it was like famously Ted Koppel asked Sheldon Adelson at one point, like, but why are you giving them all this money? So that said, I think that people can, you know, first of all, people can just talk about these things. I think the more that people know, I think that really does matter. People can write into their media. People can write letters to the editor. People can write op-eds. There are going to be demonstrations on October 8th, which is the oral argument date, as you said, both in D.C. and then also in state capitals. So you can figure out how to have your own, satellite event about something like that. Or I think that, you know, the important thing is that this is not just about this court case right now. This is about the fact that Americans are, you know, really aware of Citizens United, that kind of brought this issue to a fore, that and the increasing expense of every, you know, the huge amounts of money. But I think Citizens United really opened up people's eyes to what's been going on with dismantling the campaign finance reform system, looking around and seeing a broken Washington and, you know, thinking that their voices are not being heard on policy. And so, you know, the American public has been paying more attention to the broader question of money in politics, and I think in many ways has been pushing back. You know, there's been a push from disclosure. As I said, 600 public comments to the SEC. You know, there were tons of campaigns in New York, you know, in New York State for fair elections. Look at what's happening, what kind of campaign is going on in your state. You know, there are tons of campaigns for disclosure laws. There should be better disclosure and transparency laws. If in your state they're trying to raise the contribution limits, then, you know, you should tell them that they shouldn't do that. And, in fact, they should lower the contribution limits so that, you know, people it can be closer to what other people can afford. Really, public financing is something that people should talk to their elected officials about. So I think that that's the question. I forget, well, and I know that public opinion isn't the most important thing, but contribution limits are supported by a huge percentage of the American public. And so we just have to kind of all, you know, pull in the same direction and know that I think, you know, together, hopefully we can, if everybody does a little bit, then surely we'll be able to all do a lot.
That sounds wonderful. And I, again, I appreciate all of your time, Liz, and hanging with us for a little technical difficulty at the beginning of the show.
I can't believe the cell phone lasted
forward.
All this long.
Well, let's maybe we should just go ahead and bid you adieu and not press the matter.
Thanks,
not press
Dan.
Our luck.
Bye.
Thanks, Liz. Look forward to talking to you again sometime. All right, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Liz Kennedy of Demos, and Liz is a counsel at Demos who has worked for many years, as you can tell, on expanding political participation, preventing the undue influence of money in politics. She also served, this is one thing I didn't get to in her bio earlier, but she also served in 2008 as Deputy Director of Voter Protection for the 2008 Obama campaign in Ohio. So very, very well-versed, very well-written. She's authored or co-authored 6 or 7 different books. She's been written up in the Boston Herald, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Los Angeles Daily News, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, HuffPost, and more. So I will go ahead one more time, and I'm going to cut and paste into the chat room. I'm going to try. Windows 8. There you go. So that's www.demos.org/Liz-Kennedy, and you will get to her bio. Very, very impressive woman. Very lucky that we had her on tonight to kick off, if you were, the season of McCutcheon v. FEC Watch, the Citizens United 2. Just wanted to apologize to Chad. I was waiting and trying to get your questions in, but I did want to address one thing. You said, Chad asked from the chat room, he said, do we as citizens have access to the lists of donors, shouldn't we? So the answer is yes for these particular types. So anytime a donation is made directly to a campaign or to a party, it must be disclosed. And I should qualify that because I talked to Liz about this earlier, over $200. So any donation over $200 directly given to a candidate or a party must be disclosed. So, again, we're not talking about the PAC and the super PAC kind of money and the dark money organizations where disclosure is questionable. There are some, even within the PAC world, there are some donations that do have to be reported. But then, of course, there's the dark money and there's the organizations and there's the bundlers. And so there's all kinds of ways to get around it, right? We know that. But in particular to this, no, you do get full disclosure. And of course, as we know, we've got people like senators and Ron Wyden of Oregon, I think it's Jeff Merkley, who's fighting for, I think it's called the Follow the Money Bill, where he's fighting for disclosure. You have SEC, now people going at it through the SEC, and this is another avenue which you heard Liz hit on this, and there are people that say, you know, that are arguing now for regulation, SEC regulations, to say, look, if you own stock in a company or an owner, you have the right to know where they spend their money. And if that money is on campaign donations, then that has to be made public. And of course, there's nothing right now that forces corporations to make public their political spending. And that's just yet another way. So I think it was on our board call the other day, Eric Beiler said that Lawrence Lessig said it's many armies marching out onto the battlefield together. So as fun as this has been with Demos, et cetera, there is a coalition, and I will attempt to get that information out there as well, but there's a coalition of probably 30 or 40 different organizations involved in this, in raising awareness about McCutcheon v. FEC, and we are proud to be signing on as one the additional. Let me bring Bobby back in. Sorry I had to mute you there, brother, but I needed to get Liz off on her way.
That's okay. I understand how this works. You know that.
Okay. Yeah, really good to have somebody passionate and brilliant on our side, I think.
Yeah, you know, the case is an important one. There's no question about it. I've been talking about it since the Supreme Court decided to hear it. And recently there's been, matter of fact, we've been bouncing posts around all through the social media. I know that Janine and I have kind of been bouncing them back and forth all over the place as well. And it is important. My concerns are, you know, that the court is going to ignore the constitutional side of the argument and they're going to just continue to expand, you know, and not the gloom and doom concern, just the court. This court is ruling in on the side of money constantly, and there really, you know, there was a, I know, and we've talked about this before, there was some rulings in this last session where all the publicity went towards the Defense of Marriage Act case and the California case, for example, and meanwhile the court as a whole, with 7-2 and 9-0 and 6-3 decisions, were siding with business over and over again. And this is essentially the same kind of a ruling, though we are talking about individuals here, which hopefully maybe we'll wake the justices up and see, you know, the error of the ways before, because there's a chance that this will work. You know, it should, because it's the right argument. But this court is not one that I'm very confident in on doing what's law. I mean, even the Affordable Care Act decision, as much as I like the fact that they considered it constitutional, I thought that they decided it on the, for the wrong reasons. And they, you know, so I don't know what the court's going to do. You just never know, and that's unfortunate.
No, I totally agree with you. And as we are 47 minutes left into the show, I got to take care of business. And that would be, of course, including the fact that I got to let you know that there are 4 different Coffee Party radio shows. On Tuesdays, you can catch Press 1, on Mondays, you can catch Press 1 for Democracy. That's the show you are now listening to, so I'm sure you all know that. We start at 9 p.m. Eastern Time every Monday. And if you can't make that, then you've got Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time when Eric Beiler and a slew of guest hosts will join him to look for the middle ground. On Thursdays, you have Lunch with Loudon, and that's with Janine Loudon, our executive director and all-around brilliant person, and co-hosted typically by Debbie Lee Molino. And that's a great show, and it starts at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursdays. And then on Saturdays, you have Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis, and that starts at 1 p.m. Saturday afternoon from deep in the heart of Texas. It's fun to listen to Egberto, who tends to lean left, but is fighting the good fight from heart of Texas. So those are the 4 shows, and the next thing I need to do is I need to let you in on a little story about the Boston Tea Party.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. The Boston Tea Party is one of the most cherished stories from the founding of our country. This is one of the events that inspired the American colonists to stand up against tyranny imposed on them from the British government. Until 1764, the colonies were allowed self-rule, but with the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763, the British were low on money, so they decided to begin enforcing their trade laws to try to increase their capital. The British began to go after smuggling by searching colonial ships and convicting colonists in the British Admiralty courts. This enraged the colonists because the violators weren't given a trial by jury. Also, the British began levying taxes against the colonists on a whole host of articles, as well as tea, from sugar, coffee, stamps, and even dice and playing cards. The British didn't think they were being harsh on the American colonists, but the Americans disagreed. They believed the troops garrisoned in the colonies weren't needed since the French threat had been removed, Why would they want to pay taxes for garrisons that were only there to make sure the American colonists stayed in line? The colonists always received permission in the past from England for levying their own taxes, but now that right was being taken away, and because they didn't have their own representation in the British Parliament, they were being denied their own traditional rights as English subjects. This was going too far. In regards to the Tea Act, the British government gave the East India Company permission to transport tea, duty-free, from Great Britain to America to sell. Because they didn't have to pay the duty, it meant they could undersell the American merchants who sold tea, which would monopolize the tea trade. This would drive many colonists out of work. The Bostonians felt that something had to be done. If they allowed the tea to land and be offloaded, then the British would have had a moral victory in that the colonists were finally paying the tax they created for them. Also, there were many Tories, those still loyal to England, which would have had no problem with buying the tea. Destroying the tea seemed to be their only option. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA blog talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
And there you have your Coffee Party Civics Minute for the day. Although I always tease John a little bit because they're usually civics 2.5 minutes, but relative nonetheless, and always good to bone up on your history and get some second and third level details. John Cashin, if you don't know, is a member of the board of directors of the Coffee Party and a brilliant historian. It's fun to just sit there and listen to him wax poetic about a lot of these things. So appreciate everybody tuning in today. Again, I wanted to apologize for the technical difficulties we had at the beginning of the show. Our friends at Blog Talk Radio couldn't help it, so that I was able to, I had to log back in and call back in. So, but all's well that ends well. We had a brilliant conversation with Liz Kennedy. Of course, if you missed it, you can always download the show, or you can listen to it live on Blog Talk Radio, or not live, I guess, but you can listen to it archived on Blog Talk Radio. So, if you are still interested in talking about McCutcheon via FEC or anything else for that matter, please give us a call at 646-929-2495. We can talk about that. We can talk about the Anti-Corruption Act, which we are steadily working with Josh Silver and his group that represent us towards getting involved with in a kind of a big way. That was one of the main topics of discussion of the board call that took place yesterday. So we're moving on that. And so we're really looking to expand our collaboration with other like-minded groups like Demos, like Represent Us, and figure out ways that we can help each other get the word out and on the various actions, and they can help us, and we can expand our listenership and really make the Coffee Party, not just exist, but make it super relevant as far as being a great mode of communication. I'm going to open Bobby's mic back up. You have anything else you want to talk about tonight, Bobby?
Well, yeah, man, I've missed you, Dan. I've thought about you a lot, seriously, over the last few weeks, and there's been so many issues that have come up that have driven me crazy, like the rest of us. But, you know, I'll just say this. Every day I am energized by more people waking up and being involved and doing something important. Tomorrow I am filming a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Smith, who is one of the leading experts on GMO in our society. He's speaking at the Morehouse School of Medicine here in Atlanta. And then he's speaking at Kennesaw State on Wednesday. I'm going to be at both of them. He's the gentleman who created the documentary, The Genetic Roulette, anybody wants to look up who he is. We're expecting 500 to 600 activists there at least, which is a nice response. A number of the organizations here in Atlanta and in the Georgia general area have been talking about it and posting it and sending out emails. And I had a wonderful discussion today with his national media person about the filming and the question, the Q&A. I'm going to get to do some Q&A. And then, of course, we have the United We Stand Fest coming up by the Free and Equal Elections Foundation. And then on the same day is World Food Day is being celebrated. And we have another World March Against Monsanto on that day. So I've made arrangements with Christina Tobin and Marcy Fosgrave, my bosses at Free and Equal, to do live look-ins in different cities around the world while the United States We Stand Fest is going on to show the world, because we're going to be streamed around the world. So to show the world what's going on with the March Against Monsanto, trying to bring more organizations together. I bring up Jeffrey Smith because I wanted to introduce that gentleman to everybody in the coffee party. And of course, everybody is into food justice. And, of course, Janine Kay the most, I would say, and Devlin. And I'd like to see them. I speak to Jeffrey sometime in the show, and I've already passed that on to Jeffrey. So just trying to make the connections. George Akris is going. I'm planning the National People Against the NDAA event in January with Daniel Johnson, who, of course, has been a guest on Coffee Party Radio 3 or 4 times over the last year and a half. The wonderful 20-year-old savant, I call him, who's leading the fight against the indefinite detention sections of the NDAA. So I am energized daily while the government keeps beating the crap out of me and the rest of us. The serious situation, today's shooting, stack it on. We have the ridiculous shutdown of government situation coming up at the end of this month. 15 days away or whatever the date is. They're wearing me out, but they're not. So people like you and everybody else out there that's doing their part keeps it going. So that's kind of my conversation for this evening at this point.
That was great. It was like almost like the community calendar. What's going around? What political actions are going around the country today? That was. And now back to you. I like that. That was nice. So let's talk about the shutdown for a second, okay? So it's always this political game of chicken, but the thing is that So chicken. Just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, right? So chicken is when two guys get in cars and they face each other down and they go fast, and then one swerves at hopefully one swerves at the end, and that's the guy who's chicken, right? So that's the game they play, whether it's a debt ceiling, whether it's government shutdown, whether it's sequestration, whatever it is, it's always the game. But here's how I modify that analogy and not why it makes me so mad, because I think members of Congress on either side are not in the cars. They're remote control cars, and they've got their remote controls. We're the ones who are in the cars. We're the ones who are at risk. Nobody in Congress is at risk. We're the ones who are at risk, the regular people. And these people have no problem in playing chicken with our lives. And it angers me. I know sure. They think that they're playing out some kind of a chess game, but it's like, why do we have to? I mean, I have a full head of gray hair. If you see my picture on any of my promotional emails, I have a full head of, actually, yeah, my wife said full. I said, okay, I have a mostly full head of gray hair, which she actually would argue is white. Do I really need this to go through this every 3 months?
No. It's interesting, they're saying the fodder that's coming out of certain directions is saying that this time around the president doesn't have any incentive to negotiate and he might as well let it, shut down. Now, the comment, I'm reading this and I'm going, okay, he doesn't have any incentive from the standpoint of political incentive, but he certainly has a society incentive to do it, and then of course you turn around and you look at the chaos in the House, for example, where you take the Tea Party advocates who are for shutting down the government. And then you have the we'll call them the Boehner faction of guys who are, you know, into negotiating, but waiting while the White House negotiates with the Senate Republicans, which is kind of how it's been going. You know, but the White House and the Senate Republicans are not negotiating this time. They're not talking to each other. So there's no reliance there where the House can come and say, well, we're just following the Republicans. We're just going to get it done, and this is what we got, and we got the White House to capitulate. You know, so there's that mindset. And then, of course, you have the Democratic side of it that isn't supporting verbally right now, but not supporting any compromise. So basically, you're going to deal with the Democratic Party having a red line in the sand, which some could say is the right thing for them to do considering what's been going on. Bottom line is that, like you say, we're going to be hurt by it. You know, we have a government that refuses to do its job. You know, the fact that I'm reading this scenario based upon discussions people are having on the Hill is just so ludicrous. You know, they just barely got back to work, but they're going to ruin it again for us. And, you know, and the implications of what happens when the government is shut down like that is serious. It cannot be stated any less. It is serious, serious, serious stuff. You know, and you don't see it in 5 seconds, but you see it. Infrastructure is important in this country. Being able to cash your Social Security checks is important in this country. Being able to cash your military check is important in this country. That's the kind of things we're talking about here, as you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, we've got somebody else want to jump in here. Is this Greg?
It is. How are you guys doing?
Good, man. How are you? I hope you were here earlier for our special guest. She was.
I was.
And brilliant.
Yes, very, very much so. She was a great guest. I was just listening in via the internet. I never even got a chance to log in. I was just as a guest, so I did. I was patiently waiting for everybody to figure out the technical difficulties, and kudos for figuring that out. So she was brilliant and talking at times way over my head. So I've got a lot to learn still. But I wanted to ask the question to you guys while we're talking about you know, the next pending potential shutdown of government. Can either one of you guys convince me why this isn't totally and completely at the feet of the Republicans, and that the Democrats ought not to just say, you guys are totally to blame for the possibility of this going south? Because after voting 42 times to defund the Affordable Care Act, now you want to defund it in order to get the debt ceiling passed for programs that have already been voted and potentially funded. Now we just have to pay our bills. I think it's time, really, for the president and the Democrats to just really tell the whole GOP from top to bottom that you guys are the problem, and we're not going to play this game with you people anymore, and we're going to make sure the American people hear it. The president actually tiptoed into that a little bit today, I thought. And I think he needs to go full bore and stop being a nice guy about it, frankly. There, what is left to negotiate when it comes to the debt ceiling? Help me. Educate me. What am I missing?
I don't think you have it wrong at all to some degree, in my view. I mean, you know, my comments weren't in any way a reflection of a support or non-support for what you're saying. But, you know, I guess maybe my blame for the Democrats on this issue stems from the fact that maybe they didn't do more sooner because of the, you know, this whole process has been all about politics in the sense of we want to get reelected. We all know what they do. They get into government and they want to get reelected. And, of course, part of the deal that the president made last time was for that same reason. He was in an election year, and so were the Democrats. And, you know, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that he was going to win. God help us with Romney. But as far as where you are right now, defunding Obama's Affordable Care Act is not going to happen. With the Republicans do tend to take a position of insanity and then wind up pushing everything to the right anyway by coming off the insanity and going to the middle. Lately, I will agree with that as well.
I wish I could say I see that.
At this point, it sounds like nobody's going to move from what they're saying, right, wrong, or indifferent. I mean, even with your approach, which I don't necessarily disagree with, I want our government to function like it's supposed to, you know, and obviously you're right, and I have to agree with you in that a lot of this is coming from the Republican side when it comes to the economics. But gosh, they got it, you know, these people, they're killing us.
Go ahead, Dan.
My turn.
Go ahead.
So,
you asked the intractive,
intractability takes two. Tug of wars take two. Everything takes two. Now, I'm not saying that the Democrats are as much to blame as the Republicans. Obviously, the Republicans have established themselves as the party of no, as in we're not going to do anything. We're going to sit here with our, you know, in the corner with our hands crossed, and we're just going to pout until we get back into the majority, right? I mean, so obviously that's their gig, right? But I'm with you, Greg, and one of my frustrations overall with the president's demeanor, and it's been this way since the get-go, is that he hasn't. He's got a pulpit, right? The president, if he has one thing, if he has one special power that nobody can take away from the president, is the guy has a pulpit. And when he says, I'm going to have a press conference, and he walks down that call, John Stewart call them? When he walks down, I killed Bin Laden Hall, you know, and he struts to the podium in the White House, he's got the country in the palm of his hand. He's got their ear. Talk to us. Tell us how bad they are. Tell us that they're not playing fair. But do it in such a way that I know you're trying. Right? Because this is the thing, right? I've tried 16 times to bring a bill for jobs to the floor, and I can't even get a vote on it. I've tried 25 times to do this. I've tried 60 times to do that. Tell me you're trying. Don't just say it's them and point.
I agree.
That's my frustration. He's got the megaphone. He could do it, but he doesn't. He just doesn't do it, not as loudly as I'd like him to.
It's not his leadership style to be the guy who bangs his shoe on the podium or walks into a room like his predecessor did, as if he had a stick up his ass, with his chest pushed out and his arms swinging to the side like he was in a cowboy movie.
Civility.
Oh, come on. I mean, that was his demeanor. I'm sorry, but we should not be comparing these two guys in terms, and I don't disagree with you, by the way. One of the things you've heard me say before is using the P word to describe Democrats, that they aren't always, in fact, they're almost never as forceful as they ought to be. And again, that just isn't this guy's style. I would like to hear him pick off a bunch of those kinds of facts at every opportunity, knowing full well that the extreme right wing of the Republican Party and the Tea Party faction of the GOP is never going to hear that anyway. It doesn't really matter. The way this all gets changed is for more people for more people to vote for Democrats instead of Republicans. I'll just say it out loud. The fewer Republicans we have in government all up and down the chain, in my opinion, the better this country will be. It'll actually turn more towards middle class and working class issues. It'll actually turn more towards social acceptance. It'll actually turn more towards sustainable and renewable energy policies. It'll actually turn more towards peaceful and diplomatic solutions instead of military solutions. If you ask me, there's almost nothing, I can't think of a single thing that the Republicans have stood for in the last 12 years that I have anything in common with. And I'm a registered independent, but I haven't voted for Republicans since I can't remember when, because they just don't stand for the things that America ought to be standing for anymore. It's about exclusion. It's about aggression. It's about recalcitrance. It's about resistance. It's about obstructionism. Tell me I'm wrong. Show me I'm wrong. I would love to be wrong, but I don't think I am.
So let's assume you're right. I got no problem. Let's play your game. I always like to turn to facts in times of trouble, right? So let's visit our friend Mr. Numbers, because numbers don't lie. Statistics lie, but numbers don't lie. The approval rating for Congress right now is what percent?
14, I think.
Is it that high? I heard it was single digits last time I heard.
My wife just said
it's 12. Okay, it's 12%, right? And in the specific polling questions where they say, do you believe that your representative is representing you, it's overwhelmingly the majority of Americans say, no way, Jose. So that means, mathematically speaking, there has to be at least one district that is ready to recall a congressman, right? And I've always said from the get-go, that is what has to happen to get the message to Washington. Some of these bozos need to be recalled who are not representing the people. And so we kind of have to lay our hands or put our faith in the hands of the people of these districts. Actually, they will take that action. To me, that's the only solution.
I agree. It happens.
Let me chime in on what Greg said, if you don't mind, real quick.
No, go ahead.
I have a little bit broader view of the problem than you do, from the standpoint of what I agree with and what I don't agree with. I start with Iraq, for example. Well, start with the Patriot Act, for example, in 2001. When you have a Senate that votes 98-1 with one person not there, then they're all on board with supplanting our constitutional rights. Now, there has been a number of Democrats since that time that will argue about, I'll give up my constitutional rights for safety. Well, I won't. Democrat or Republican, I will not. I ask you, like I ask all the time, name me 10 people in Washington, I don't care what party, that you can honestly say is working for their constituents and not big money, please. Because I'm at 6 right now, and 3 of them are from Oregon, so I say we should just move to Oregon.
You are welcome here anytime, my friend.
What's the housing market like in Portland?
It's okay. Portland itself was one of the most 5 depressed areas in the country. It was right up there with Atlanta, but it's coming back. There's actually there's very good signs in Oregon. So there's cranes all over the city. There's new buildings going up, buildings being demolished, new buildings being built. So we're looking good. We're looking good. So
good.
You're absolutely right. I mean, especially our senators. I mean, they're awesome. I mean, but even our Congress people are great. And
I couldn't name 6. I readily admit that. So, my comments were mostly around ideology and mostly around policy.
Maybe what we need to do is
all right, so let's move forward into Solutionville, right? We have to free the elected. You know, we've been talking about freeing the elected. We've been talking about, you know, we had our special guest tonight talking about campaign finance reform from a legal point of view, et cetera, et cetera. But we also have this represent us gig, right, with the Anti-Corruption Act.
Yes.
I know you're a big fan, Greg. Why don't you go ahead and give that a plug?
Yes. Happy to give it a plug. So far, in my limited knowledge and research, that to me looks like the most realistic and efficacious way to change the effect of money in politics without having to go down the path of amending the Constitution. It looks to me like the sort of thing that my goodness, if just a few percentage points of Americans had some kind of awareness about, actually took some time to just, you know, quickly consider the way this act has been constructed, and then to very much like what the Coffee Party wants to do with the 535 campaign is to make our elected officials go on record as either supporting it completely or knowing that they are going to be campaigned against because they clearly don't have our best interests at heart. I have just, you know, personally, and I think I've shared some of this with you guys. I mean, I've got Hootsuite set up to be tweeting about this on an ongoing basis. I'm just one little guy. I think I've got 25 people so far that have signed on to my website, or my Represent Us site. It's not my website. It's the Represent Us page that now has my name on it. Kind of, it's where I have people come and become citizen co-sponsors. I would love it, man. Just think of it. If there was 500,000 Facebook friends of Coffee Party and we all got 25 people to co-sponsor this thing, man, do the math. I just think that's huge. I think that's really, really a wonderful possibility, and I hope it works out for everybody that way.
Okay, well, so for those of you listening, the organization is called Represent Us, and the legislation they put together is called the Anti-Corruption Act. If you go to www.representus.org or com.
I think it's represent.us.
Oh, okay.
Anti-corruption.org, I think, is also a website in which the act is more explained.
Okay. So would it make you happy to know that on Sunday's call, without being giving away too much specifics, we took one very, very, very giant step towards being in that camp and being actively involved, the Coffee Party?
Yeah, I heard that earlier. That's wonderful news. I think that's wonderful news.
But Bobby, what's your take on the Anti-Corruption Act?
I joined it the second I read it when I was listening to the gentleman on the Middle Ground a long time ago. It is an absolutely excellent piece of proposed legislation. Actually, Greg had kind of reintroduced it into my thought processes because, of course, you know, they wear us all out, and sometimes things drop from my brain. And it is an absolutely wonderful idea if it would be done. It kind of goes hand in hand with what's been done in Arkansas with the amendment to the state constitution. The language is very similar. Actually, Greg pointed that out when Deckelman was on the show. Greg Deckelman was on the show, who was involved in that, and he called in after Christina Togan was interviewed and told us all about it. So I've been monitoring that as well, because of course that's going to be voted on, and we're waiting to see how much money comes out against it. Kind of the way the Monsanto legislation or the GMO legislation up in Seattle is being attacked right now. The 522 Act, you know, the corporate money is just waiting to show up. But it is an excellent piece of legislation, and again, it would work if society would be involved and hold them accountable and vote them out of office if they did not take the pledge. And that's essentially what they're doing, is they would take the pledge, sign on board, that they would not behave in this way and support the legislation. And if they didn't, you would vote them out of office. You would work to vote them out of office. It's a wonderful idea. It's a fantastic idea. They're all wonderful ideas. And really, it just takes getting the elected people involved. Dan, as you know, 90 million people didn't vote. So I'll take those 90 million, and all we got to do is change the mind of maybe another 5 or 6 million, and then maybe we can straighten this stuff out.
Let's get the first 90. That'd be a good start. So the goal as has been explained to us is that they want to get 1,000 people per district, citizen sponsors per district. And by the way, Greg, you were absolutely right. It's www.represent.us, and you can go there and you can sign up. And if they're looking to get 1,000 per district, and then you know, then once they have that, then they can go on record and, you know, congressional districts, I think I did the math once, and I want to say it's about 115,000 per district. Yeah, I'll have to go back and do the math, but it was something of that magnitude. And so, you know, even 1,000 people, you're getting close to 1%, right? So, I mean, that's significant, right? If you get, obviously, you had another zero, now you're at 10%. So I think it's a great cause. They're doing, you know, similar work to us or what we were going to do with the 535, and it's looking very good. So I wanted to leave you with that bit of hope that we are going to be able to do something positive, have a positive impact. And I think you're going to see this more and more, as we did with Demos on the McCutcheon thing. Again, there's a whole coalition of organizations that we are now involved with that we are going to be playing more with and doing more of these shows where we're going to be having their people on and promoting their actions and growing the awareness of the Coffee Party amongst their organizations, which will only help us. And by helping us, of course, that helps our ability to help them. So it's one of those big, you know, things that should spiral out of control in a good way.
Hey, Dan.
Occupy Little Rock wants to have the Coffee Party on their show, I've been told. It's passed on, by the way. I've got to send you an email. I need to send
me an email. You know I'm the guy. I'm the coordinator.
I know you're the guy.
Third-party organization.
Are you coming to the United We Stand Fest?
Still have not been able to nail it down. I am trying like heck to be able to juggle my schedule to make it happen.
Yeah, because you told me that you have to be in San Diego the following week. I think you said that.
Yes, exactly.
Well, then that's a no-brainer. What's to work out? Just get in the car, man. It's Highway 1, if anybody didn't tell you. It's Highway 1 South. If you want to take the scenic route, it goes all the way.
Yeah, it's actually Highway 5, but that's okay.
No, Highway 5 is the interstate. I said the scenic route. You know, I like going.
Oh, yeah. So you're saying I should start now.
Yeah, start now.
Yes, Pacific Coast Highway is a little slow. Yes, I must admit, it's a little slow.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So, I mean, nothing like going up like you're in, you know, by Big Sur.
You know, the biggest response from communities and elected officials for the NDAA issues has come in Oregon as well. Dan Johnson spends a lot of time out there, and he has a large group of people working with local governments out there. Coos Bay being the first, being the head of it, being the biggest one. Large responses, a lot of interaction with local media and stuff like that. Oregon is interesting; always has been.
Hey, Dan.
I was not aware. Yes, sir.
I was going to make a couple of other suggestions, just, you know, kind of food for thought as you think about how to get integrated with some of these other organizations. I'm a big believer in keeping things simple. And so anything that the Coffee Party can do that lets people make their voices heard without having to do a lot of work, I think, and I mean, this is kind of like the Captain Obvious statement, they're more likely to do it. And some of the, I'm happy to have you guys distribute those tweets that I sent you and let people copy and paste them in, or if you guys want to use them and schedule them up with, I don't know if you use an application like Hootsuite or something like that to be able to manage your social media feeds, but you know, getting that kind of a consistent presence and a message out and giving it to people to let them just kind of click and go, kind of like that Twitter conversation I had with Dana Rohrbach that Egberto was talking about on Saturday. I mean, that happened because the website that I went to literally let me send that guy a tweet with a single click. Took me no energy at all. Was glad to do it. Those kinds of tactics, I think in the age of you know, perpetual ADD and social media will engage people in a much more, at least voluminous way, if you just make it as easy as possible for them.
I concur, and maybe we need to hook you up with the, if you're not already, with the internet, what is it, the internet work group, there's an internet work group, internet and technology work group. So maybe we need to start looking into the establishing some of those tools. Well suggested,
I'd be happy,
sir.
I'd be happy to help. You know, just, you know, let me, tell me who I need to talk to, or, you know, I'd happy to, you know me, I'm not bashful about offering my opinion and my thoughts on things.
And I noticed it about you, Greg. Of course, that's what makes you such a good caller.
I think that's a characteristic the three of us probably share.
Yeah, exactly. All right, guys, I am going to wind it down here, so we'll kind of do the checkout thing, starting with you, Greg. Final thoughts.
Hey, this was this kind of show is really, I think, is indicative of how important it is for the coffee party to keep the conversation going, to get the kinds of guests like you had on tonight, to now continue to spread the word in as many different ways as possible with as many like-minded organizations. I mean, it's just that, you know, it's one of those issues where I think the sum is greater than the parts, or however that saying goes. And we need to continue, I think, to encourage you to reach out to those like-minded groups, and let's leverage the action and the energy that everybody has.
Consider it promised. Bobby Rodrigo, final thoughts?
I would like everybody to read the entire Constitution by the end of the weekend so they know what we're fighting for and why the elected officials are not paying any attention to it on a daily basis. I was curious what you guys, we don't have to talk about it, we could do this next week, but I want to know what you guys think of the new word in our dictionary that was created by Bill Maher, black tracking. I'm sure you've seen it, and if you haven't, please look it up so we can discuss it at a future date. I think that's a lot of what's going on in our society, or in our Washington political society. Keep up the good fight, everybody. Pay attention, and don't let your elected officials get away with anything.
That's it. Beautiful. Thanks, Bobby. All right, so we all have our homework for next week. We are going to familiarize ourselves for and prepare ourselves for the discussion on black tracking. Boy, that sounds dangerous. but you know what? We'll just leave it at that till next week. So you have been listening to Press One for Democracy, and I'd like to thank all of our regular wonderful callers, Bobby Rodrigo, Greg Rasek, and a special shout-out to Liz Kennedy, our wonderful special guest, an attorney from Demos, who is rallying the troops and helping to fight against the impending round two of Citizens United, known better as McCutcheon v. FEC. And it is something that everybody needs to definitely go out and do their homework on, maybe even more than black tracking. Familiarize yourself with this. Arguments begin at the Supreme Court on October 8th. And in short, they're arguing to remove limits on aggregate limits on direct campaign donations. So there's a limit on how much money a person can give to a total number of politicians, and they're trying within a certain period of time, and they're trying to get that raised, so or eliminated, actually. So everybody needs to be aware on that, be vigil on that, be vigil on everything else, be vigil on your government, watch your government, right? Because as the song says, watchdog of justice who keeps their eye on you. And that is a real simple answer. It's me, it's you, it's everybody. So let's stay vigilant, stay aware, and stay well. And I look forward to seeing everybody or hearing everybody next Monday. Thanks for tuning in, folks.